From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, stormy weather. Novelist Carl Hiaasen has a new comic thriller, and once again, the setting is South Florida. This time, Hiaasen skewers the rip-off artists and corrupt construction companies that take advantage of hurricane victims. Also, stand-up comic Suzanne Westenhofer. She uses her humor to challenge stereotypes about gays and lesbians. Westenhofer was the first lesbian to have a comedy special on HBO, and recently she was part of the lineup on Comic Relief. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings by the British singers soprano Maggie Tate and tenor Hetal Nash. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, this news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Clinton says he will not give in to Republican pressure over the budget, even if it means a shutdown of federal government offices.
I cannot and will not, under pressure, sign a budget that will rob the American dream from millions of Americans, divide our people instead of uniting them, and undermine our ability to remain the strongest nation in the world and the greatest force for those things we believe in.
But House Speaker Newt Gingrich says by vetoing a stopgap spending bill to keep the government operating, Mr. Clinton will also be signaling that he refuses to balance the budget.
We gave our word to the American people. We are going to keep our word to the American people. We hope the president will sign the resolution today and keep the government open. We hope the president will decide to agree with us to balance the budget. We hope the president will reverse his decision to veto the welfare bill. And we hope the president will recognize that he's the president of the American people.
Already, Mr. Clinton has vetoed a measure to extend temporarily the government's ability to borrow money. He says the bill had too many unacceptable amendments. As for the stopgap spending bill, the key sticking point cited by the president is an amendment to raise Medicare premiums. So Senate Budget Committee Chairman Pete Domenici is floating a compromise proposal. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Under current law, Medicare Part B premiums are scheduled to drop in January from $46 a month to about $43 a month. The temporary budget bill would instead raise those premiums. With the president vowing to veto the bill because of that increase, Domenici told reporters today that he's talked with Republican leaders and the White House about just leaving the premiums alone.
Perhaps the solution is to freeze that at $46.10 for 3 or 4 months. Everybody wins. The $46.10 means nobody gets an increase, nobody gets a decrease. You have time to work this provision out.
Domenici cautions that this is not yet a formal offer. If it were agreed to, it would leave the level of temporary funding as the final disagreement in the effort to avoid a government shutdown. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
The U.S. Embassy in Saudi Arabia now says 4 Americans, not 5, were killed in the bomb attack on a U.S.-run military training center in Riyadh today. Over 30 Americans were injured in the blast, which is believed to have been caused by a car bomb. It was the most deadly attack on Americans in the Middle East since the Marine barracks in Beirut were hit by a suicide bombing in 1983. State Department spokesman Nicholas Burns says a team of FBI experts will depart for Riyadh this evening to help with the investigation of the blast. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 9.75 points at 4880.12 in moderate trading. On the over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is down a fraction of a point. This is NPR News. A nonprofit television watchdog group says local television news programs titillate more than they inform. The Rocky Mountain Media Watch in Denver has released a survey that found much local TV news time is devoted to everything from celebrity stories to anchor chit-chat. New York City transit riders paid 20% more today than they did yesterday as the cost of a bus or subway ride went from $1.25 to $1.50. The twisted route to that fare hike meant long lines at token booths. From New York, NPR's Melissa Block reports.
First, the fare hike was on, then it was off, then it was on again. The increase was challenged in court by two groups who claim it disproportionately affects city riders, more than half of whom are minorities. Suburban commuter lines with mostly white ridership saw a smaller increase. One judge issued an injunction against the fare hike, then an appeals panel overturned his ruling and the increase went through. But it's not over yet. There's another hearing tomorrow on whether to return to the lower fare. And the whole thing won't be settled until the case goes to trial. What all this has meant for city bus and subway riders is chaos at token booths. Many people trying to get ahead of Monday morning delays got online in the cold to buy tokens yesterday. Some waited for as long as an hour. I'm Melissa Block in New York.
The board of directors of the parent company of United Airlines is meeting today in Illinois to consider whether to make a bid to buy U.S. Air. United's employees own a majority stake in the company, so any merger would have to have their support. The Supreme Court has denied an appeal by former Texas Congressman Albert Bustamante, who was convicted on charges of racketeering and accepting an illegal gift. He's been sentenced to 42 months in prison and fined $55,000. A federal appeals court had upheld his conviction, but his lawyers had argued the evidence failed to show proof of criminal intent. The charges against Bustamante included taking a $35,000 bribe to use his influence to help a San Antonio firm. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. As a native Floridian, Carl Hiaasen knows his hurricanes. He's covered them for the Miami Herald, where he worked as a reporter and is now a columnist. Back in 1987, he outraged Miami's mayor for saying that there was nothing wrong with South Florida that a Force 5 hurricane couldn't fix. The mayor asked him to apologize. Hiaasen declined. All of Hiaasen's novels reflect his concerns about the survival of Florida's delicate and storm-prone environment, overrun with theme parks, malls, superhighways, and shoddily built housing developments. His latest novel, Stormy Weather, is about the scam artists and corrupt construction and insurance companies that take advantage of hurricane victims. Hiaasen said that much of the novel was pulled right out of the headlines, including this episode.
Among the stream of outlaws who raced south in the feverish hours following the hurricane was a man named Gil Peck. His plan was to pass himself off as an experienced mason, steal what he could in the way of advance deposits, then haul ass back to Alabama. The scam had worked flawlessly against victims of Hurricane Hugo in South Carolina, and Gil Peck was confident it would work in Miami, too. He arrived in a 4-ton flatbed carrying a small but authentic-looking load of red bricks, which he'd ripped off from an unguarded construction site in Mobile, a new cancer wing for a pediatric hospital. Gil Peck had caught the festive groundbreaking on TV. That afternoon, he'd backed up the flatbed, helped himself to the bricks, and driven nonstop to South Florida. So far, business was booming. Gil Peck had collected almost $2,600 in cash from half a dozen desperate homeowners, all of whom expected him to return the following Saturday morning with his truckload of bricks. By then, of course, Gil Peck would be northbound and gone. By day, he worked the hustle. By night, he scavenged hurricane debris. The big flatbed conveyed an air of authority, and no one questioned its presence. Even after curfew, the National Guardsmen waved him through the flashing barricades. Many valuables had survived the storm's thrashing, and Gil Peck became an expert at mining the rubble. An inventory of his 2-day bounty included a bagel toaster, a Stairmaster, a silver tea set, 3 off-brand assault rifles, a Panasonic cellular telephone, 2 pairs of men's golf spikes, a waterproof kilogram package of hashish, a brass chandelier, a scuba tank, a gold-class ring from the University of Miami, a set of police handcuffs, a collection of rare Finnish pornography, a Michael Jackson hand puppet, an unopened bottle of 100-milligram Darvocets, a box set of Willie Nelson albums, a Loomis fly rod, a birdcage, and 21 pairs of women's bikini-style panties. Exploring the demolished remains of a mobile home park, Gil Peck was a happy fellow. There was a bounce to his step as he followed the yellow beam of the flashlight from one ruin to another. Thanks to the National Guard, the Highway Patrol, and the Dade County Police, Gil Peck was completely alone and unmolested in the summer night, free to plunder. And what he spied in the middle of a shuffleboard court made his greedy heart flutter with joy. A jumbo TV dish. The hurricane undoubtedly had uprooted it from some millionaire's estate and tossed it here for Gil Peck to salvage. With the flashlight, he traced the outer parabola and found one small dent. Otherwise, the 8-foot satellite receiver was in top condition. Gil Peck grinned and thought, man, I must be living right. A dish that big was worth a couple grand easy. Gil Peck thought it might fit nicely in his own backyard, behind the chicken coops. He envisioned free HBO for the rest of his natural life.
And that's Carl Hiaasen reading from his latest novel. It's called Stormy Weather. So as a journalist and as someone who has covered hurricanes in South Florida, how many Gilpecs move in on the aftermath of a hurricane?
Well, when I was a kid and these things happened, I don't remember the sort of a wave, the assault wave of this kind of scoundrel that we had after Hurricane Andrew. And certainly the folks in South Carolina remember after Hugo and maybe Camille in the Gulf Coast states. I think it's sort of a new phenomenon. But when you had and part of it is the media. We had extensive, vast media coverage of that storm when Andrew hit in 92. And I think it inspired a lot of bad folks to try to come down and take advantage of the situation. And they did, sadly enough, along with all the volunteers and the church groups and the National Guard and the Red Cross. You had these kinds of maggots who sort of crawled their way down there and made a lot of money and got out before they could be arrested.
Well, how were they able to work so easily?
There was no law and order. I mean, after a storm, you had, in a space of 4 hours, 200,000 people put out of their homes, 125,000 homes destroyed partially or completely. Everyone's attention was to the survivors and to restoring some sort of, you know, communication, electricity, traffic lights. You can't imagine, unless you've been through a hurricane, there's just nothing. And so these people, all the efforts of the authorities were just traffic control. And if you're desperate and you're sitting there and your kids don't have a roof over their head and their water is dripping, mosquitoes, and somebody pulls up with a truck that says he's a roofer or a mason or whatever he is, and you just want to get some shelter and you're willing to pay them even though they're not licensed and even though they may have been a bartender the night before and just decided all of a sudden to put on roofs. And that happened a lot.
And would these maggots, as you described them, would they target particular kinds of people, or was everyone in such desperate states?
There was no shortage of victims. You know, I mean, it was just an open season, and this is just one element. I mean, you had other kinds of folks down there who certainly appear in the novel as well, but the opportunism, it was at a fever pitch. It was a chance. Also, you got to realize that not just in the days after the storms, but in the weeks after the storm, you had millions of dollars in insurance money that was coming into South Florida. Millions and millions of dollars. A lot of these companies were paying off very quickly. It's good PR to do that after a storm. So you had people with some cash.
A lot of cash.
And FEMA was down there giving out checks to people. So you had folks walking around. Mm-hmm. And with that money, you know, it worked both ways. You had homeowners who thought they could sort of make a deal. They got $10,000 to put a new roof on. What if they could find someone to put the roof on for $5,000? And then the other $5,000 they could maybe put in a new swimming pool. And that happened a lot. And then they found out that whoever they hired to put on the roof may have been not exactly qualified. So, you know, it was an unbelievable time. There was an actual boom in terms of the economy, as bizarre as this sounds. In the months after the storm, there was a tremendous boom in South Florida's economy because all this insurance money. And now we're just getting almost 3 years later to the point where that money's spent, and we're sort of catching up with the rest of the country and sort of flattening out.
Well, who do you blame? And in your book, in your novel, there are many targets here. But who do you hold ultimately responsible for the kind of ripoffs that you both have written about as a journalist and as a novelist?
Well, the ripoffs being one part of it. I mean, you have to look at the whole political structure that says, you know, we live in a hurricane zone. And you can bet that there's going to be more hurricanes, and just as there have been. So what we're going to do is we're going to cram 5 million human beings into the Gold Coast of Florida in houses that are built like popsicle sticks, many of them, and we're just going to dare the hurricane to come. And when it comes, we're going to claim we didn't know it was going to be this bad. So the whole political in Florida, the whole political engine is fueled with construction money, development money, bank money. Growth is the industry. We don't produce a lot of other things. And the problem is that it's nature's way of saying, all right, this is the price you pay. It would be like saying, I'm going to take my life savings and build a big house for my family on the San Andreas Fault because I don't think there's going to be any more earthquakes. I mean, that's about how bright it is.
Well, you have a character called Skink. He's actually an ex-governor turned renegade environmentalist. And he says hurricanes are an eviction notice from God. Is he the fictional Carl Hiaasen?
Well, I mean, I think it's a true statement. He's appeared in just a couple other my novels. He's sort of a moral compass. And he's a radical. He's a radical something. I mean, he lives in the swamp and he eats roadkill, but he has nuggets of wisdom that he imparts. And he also says in the novel that a hurricane is a holy thing. And what he means by that is that if you can step back away from the wreckage that it causes to humanity and see sort of how it's – I mean, they've been hitting Florida for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. They're going to keep hitting Florida. It's an awesome natural force. I mean, it's an incredible thing to be a part of and to watch, and it has its own sort of fearsome beauty, and that was what he's talking about there, and that's why during the course of the storm he decides to strap himself to a bridge so he can watch it firsthand. Which I wouldn't recommend, by the way.
Well, you've never done that, have you?
No.
But you blame politicians then for, I guess, saying to the rest of the world, hey, come on down, the water's great, the weather's fine, come in and live in Florida.
Not just that, but for caving into the special interests that say, please weaken our building code. You know, we had 30 years between Hurricane Donna and Hurricane Andrew where we didn't have a big storm. The result was that you had 70% to 80% of the people who got hit by Hurricane Andrew had never been through a hurricane. And apparently the people who built their homes had never been through a hurricane because a lot of them were incompetent, corruptly inspected, just shamefully unprepared for the storm. I don't blame the folks who lived there, but certainly the system over the years, the politicians had gradually weakened the building code to the point where for instance, nails were no longer required in shingles. They could staple shingles to the roofs. Now, if you've ever been in an 80-mile-an-hour wind, much less 160-mile-an-hour wind, you know how foolish and stupid that is. But that's how lax the building codes had gotten. So, you know, the whole system is corrupt in that sense.
Well, you're talking about then flying debris. If things are literally not nailed down,
shrapnel. It was like every trailer, every mobile home, and in the path of that storm. Thousands and every single one was destroyed. And you can say, anyone who lives in a mobile home in a hurricane zone deserves what they get. Fine, but the problem is that those things become shrapnel, and they fly through the air like a beer can, and except they weigh a couple tons, and they destroy everything in their path. So a lot of the deaths and injuries came because of that. And you have to look at the larger good of the community saying, isn't this not a very bright thing to have these big mobile home parks in a hurricane zone? And so there's all this movement. Yeah, you're right. We can't do this anymore. The destruction was, of course, they backed off a couple months after the storm. And we've got just as many as we had before. Many of them put there by the federal government.
Is Florida on a collision course with Mother Nature? I guess always been that way.
Well, it's always been that way. And I think many parts of this country are. And if you look at what's happened to the eastern seaboard the last few years, even just hurricanes just nicking them. These are things to be reckoned with. And, you know, when Hurricane Hugo hit South Carolina, these barrier islands you built, they had these incredibly expensive homes that all blew away. Well, big surprise. I mean, who could possibly be surprised by that? Well, all the people that built the homes, you know, not the folks who lived there, but the builders, geez, we thought they'd withstand a storm. Well, they had no clue. They had no clue what they're dealing with. So in a lot of my novels, I mean, sort of a recurring theme is not just the sort of the recuperative power of nature, but sometimes sort of the vengeful power of nature. And you know, hurricanes are going to keep pounding. We used to, back in the 40s and 50s, it was not uncommon to have two or three storms every year hit the mainland of Florida. And back then, they were building homes that stood up because they just planned on the fact that they were going to get hit. And when you had a period that passed without the storms, of course, all those concerns sort of were forgotten, and we paid a terrible, terrible price in 1992.
Well, as you mentioned, storms have worked their way up at least the eastern seaboard and done a lot of damage. So I don't think Florida or Floridians are alone in this idea. It seems like a very American idea that we're in control of nature, damn it, and we're going to live precisely how we want, and we're going to then change nature, try to change nature so that it can accommodate our needs.
All right. Well, I mean, that's one thing that is always going to be true, is that you cannot alter the course of these storms. You can build better houses and you can build seawalls and all that, but you can't stop these storms from coming. And another phenomenon that isn't unique to Florida, but that we found after Andrew, and which is certainly a big part of the book, is this sort of macabre fascination with natural disasters that we have. We had people pouring into Dade County, tourists coming down to see the hurricane damage as if it were an extension of their Disney World vacation or their SeaWorld vacation. And one of the characters in the book comes
Max
down.
Max Lamb, right?
He changes course on his honeymoon, brings his new bride down there. They'd just been at Disney World, and he says, well, we're never going to get to see a hurricane. They're from New York. And let's go down and see what a hurricane did. And as insensitive and callous and as that sounds, that was happening to such an extent that on several occasions the police had to go on on the air and beg people to please stay out of the hurricane zone unless they were rescue workers, because you had all these rubberneckers with their video cameras and their Nikons taking pictures, and people's lives are in ruins all around them, and they're taking pictures of overturned buses and wrecked houses like it's all part of the family album. And I found that behavior so appalling that I felt compelled to put Max in the book and to have Max dealt with in an appropriate way.
Well, not to give too much of the plot away, but Max is kidnapped by Skink. That's mm-hmm. the ex-governor turned right. renegade environmentalist. And at one point, and I wanted to ask you about your attitude towards Torres. At one point, Skink is kind of grilling him, like, do you really know what Florida was,
right.
is about?
Giving him a little quiz, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember any parts of that quiz?
Well, he was asking...
We'll see if the audience can pass or fail it.
Well, he was asking him... in particular, if he knew who wrote The River of Grass, which is a book that all Floridians should know about. It's a book about the Everglades. And poor Max, mistakenly guesses Marjorie Kinnon Rawlings.
Who wrote The Yearling.
Right. And for that, he's punished in a way that we won't go into. He should have said Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. But it's just sort of Skink's way of saying, you know, you come down here with your video camera and your package of tickets to Disney World, and you don't have a clue. You know, you're just here, and you think this is all for your amusement. And that's certainly, I think, a little episode that a lot of us, not just native Floridians, but folks who've lived there for years and years and who, you know, really care about the place, sort of resent that attitude. But it's not just here. I mean, if you talk to folks in Montana and Wyoming, what they put up with the Yellowstone
sure.
crowd,
sure.
the people who've in the Winnebagoes, bumper to bumper in Yellowstone, some of the most egregiously stupid behavior I've ever seen in my
life.
Well,
what do you expect people to do on their summer vacation, not come to Florida?
No, I mean, I'm just saying their behavior in general, certainly they could come, but it's the really sort of, you know, marginally brain-dead type of behavior that you have to question. I remember sitting in Yellowstone watching a woman with her children chasing a full-grown moose across a meadow trying to take a picture. I don't know if you know anything about what a moose can do, but most northerners certainly know that it can stomp you into sawdust in about 20 seconds, and she was determined to get a picture of her little girl with this full-grown moose. Mm. And rangers were screaming at her. I mean, this kind of behavior. If Darwin were alive, I think he would say, just let her go ahead and do that, and let the herd be thinned, you know?
So to speak. But do you think, and maybe this is having interviewed you before on some of the other novels that you've written about Florida, but do you really want to sort of stop people at the border and see if...
No, I've been an advocate of a visa system for
okay.
a long time.
Well, how would it work?
Well, I mean, you certainly can come to Florida and enjoy Florida, and then after, you give them 10 days, 2 weeks, and you leave. Goodbye. I mean, we just got too many people, and or else you balanced it. We have a certain amount of people leaving Florida now in steady numbers, but we have... Right now, our net gain a day is 770 people moving to Florida permanently every day. That's net. That's after deaths. That's after everything else, and which is a city about a new city the size of Tampa every single year coming to Florida. I don't know. I would love to know if Pennsylvania could absorb that kind of mass of humanity coming in.
Carl Hiaasen is a columnist at the Miami Herald. His latest novel is called Stormy Weather. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Carl Hiaasen is a columnist at the Miami Herald and the author of several novels that lampoon particular Florida institutions. A few years ago, he wrote Native Tongue, which took aim at the state's theme parks. When was the last time you went to Disney World? Or did you ever take your son when he was little?
When he was very little, yeah. We went there a couple times. And at the time, I was living and working in Central Florida, so I had to go there on some assignments. And and when you have a little kid, it's a different experience. Mm-hmm. But when you have to cover it as a journalist, and you sort of, and there's some, believe me, everyone there is very nice. They're almost too nice. They're so nice, you want someone
they're program nice.
I know,
aren't they?
And you want someone to throw something. You want to hear someone cuss. you want to see something go wrong. And I'll never forget what was raining one day, bitterly raining, and I had to go across the park to meet a celebrity for an interview. And the public relations person who was with me says, "Now I'm going to take you a secret way to this to the interview, but you've got to promise you won't write about this. And I said, what way? And he goes, well, we're going underground. And I'd never been in the catacombs under Disney World before. And you go down, literally like they move a dumpster and a trap door comes up and you go down the trap door. And all of a sudden you're down there and this is where all the garbage is moved. This is where all the food and this is where all the characters have to hang out before they pop up on the streets. And so the first thing I see is like Mickey Mouse sitting down there. He's got his head off and it's under his arm. You know, he's like drinking a Coke or smoking a cigarette or something. And it was kind of a neat, it was the first human view of the park that I'd had. And so I incorporated some of that into the novel. But I don't particularly enjoy the place because nothing spontaneous ever happens there. I mean, I tell people if you really want to go have some fun, go to like the Gatorland Zoo where they have like 6,000 alligators that half the time are eating each other. You know, I mean, you want to see what Florida, this, the problem with Disney World is it could be anywhere. It could be in Mesa, Arizona.
So. Well, the thing about the Disney experience is that what you experience is what I experience. I mean, it is the kind of franchise fast food.
Well, you know,
entertainment.
And when things happen spontaneously, it doesn't always go well there. A few years ago, I'd written about, the Herald had written about this at some length. They have some frontier land or frontier river, I don't know what. Anyway, it's a log cabin. For some reason, some buzzards, wild turkey buzzards, of which we have many in Florida, started showing up. They had a tremendous attraction for the place. And these were not audio animated. These were real vultures. And the Disney people didn't know what to do because they didn't want any real, like, buzzards, because the buzzards were like looking at the caged birds with great lust and hunger. And so the Disney solution at the time was a couple of their folks kind of got out of hand and tried to settle the buzzard issue with baseball bats. And the animal rights folks got very upset, and Disney had to apologize to the buzzards, to the Buzzard Friends Society or whatever it was. And then, of course, they responded with this great public relations thing. Now they have a huge, you know, sort of, you know, endangered species program and everything else. But at the time, it was an illustration of they didn't really know how to cope with Florida nature. And so I wanted a theme park where nature intruded once in a while.
Carl Hiaasen is a columnist with the Miami Herald. His novel Striptease is being made into a movie starring Demi Moore and Burt Reynolds. His latest novel is called Stormy Weather. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, lesbian stand-up comic Suzanne Westenhofer. She plays to audiences in the comedy clubs and in the classroom. She'll tell us which crowd is tougher. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews recordings by soprano Maggie Tate and tenor Hetal Nash. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Westenhofer, a famous lesbian comedian. Yeah, big deal, right? Everybody's a lesbian comedian now. There are millions of us. Everyone's a lesbian. Have you noticed that? More and more people are lesbian. I knew as soon as we started to dress better, everyone would want to be us.
5 years ago, Suzanne Westenhofer did her first three-minute stand-up, won $25, and has not looked back. Called one of the most confident comedians on stage, she uses her humor to poke fun at herself and the gay community and to engage in some good-natured straight bashing. She's performed in clubs all over the country and was the first lesbian to have a comedy special on HBO called Nothing in My Closet But My Clothes. This past weekend, she appeared in Comic Relief to help raise money for the homeless. When she's not performing, Westenhofer talks to high schoolers about being gay, using herself, she says, as a human visual aid. Like her stage routine, she wants to challenge enduring stereotypes and myths about homosexuality. I asked her whether her audiences are a mix of gay and straight people.
Generally, they're not mixed, which is good, because the mixed audiences are very difficult to do, because the gay people are all afraid that I'll say something to offend any of the straight people who are there. And the straight people spend the entire show looking around going, hey, who's gay? Mm. Are they gay? Mm. Well, she doesn't look gay. Do people think I'm gay? You know, there's just this dynamic that's going on that I'm basically on the stage going, hey, me, I'm on stage. Let's pay attention to me, please.
Well, you've been performing for about 5 years. Have you seen a change? If audiences are any indication of the public at large, would you say that things are changing for gays and lesbians?
The straight audiences have not changed dramatically. And you know that because if you watch talk shows, I mean, there's been a gazillion different talk shows, different ones of gay, about gay things, and it's still the same five questions. How'd you get to be that way? Maybe you need a real man. Don't you know it's supposed to be Adam and Eve? You're an abomination. It's the same thing. Nothing has changed. That has not changed.
And you've heard it all, I assume.
Oh, man. But if you talk about gay audiences, they have changed. It used to be that when you got up and said you were a gay comic, they just went off the wall and you could have said anything. You could have read from the phone book. But they're getting a little savvy now, and it's not just enough to say you're queer. They'd like to hear some humor. So I noticed that you really got to go out there and just be like any other comic and be funny, which is great.
Well, what I read, I guess, was that, and you always have to check whether these are true or not.
Oh, that's true, isn't it?
Well, that you, I guess, decided to try out on to do 3 minutes of comedy, something you'd never officially done before.
This
is about 5 years ago.
It was July 31st, 1990.
You remember?
It was my first time, yeah.
Well, where did
doing
you
comedy.
Where did you think? I mean, what made you think, okay,
well, for a year, I pounded my head against the wall for a couple of reasons. First of all, I thought, oh, I can't be a comic. I don't know anything about comedy. And I went to a comedy class. I wouldn't even get up and perform. I didn't want anything to do with it. And then the other part was, okay, now if I do decide to do comedy, well, I've been out now for, like, I've been out since I was 20. Well, and this was when I was 30. What am I going to do all of a sudden go, and let me tell you this really great story about my good boyfriend. And, you know, I didn't want to go there. But everybody was saying, well, but if you're out, then you only ever play gay clubs. If you're in, you'll get to go on television and be like anybody else. And maybe you can wait until you get famous and come out. That was always the big thing. But, you know, as soon as they said that I couldn't do it, then it was the only thing I wanted to do.
Yeah, and this seems like a consistent part of
kind of a
life.
Thing, yeah. I think it's because I'm Aries. What do you think?
I don't know.
So I hate rules.
So what? You had to come up with 3 minutes?
I did. I took off that day of work, and I climbed under the covers in my bed all day and thought up of 3 minutes of gay comedy. And I was terrified because this was, although the club itself was owned by a gay woman, it was an open mic that they did every night, every Monday. And it was all straight people in the audience, straight comics, you know. And so I was, and the jokes were just awful. It was like, hi, I'm Suzanne Westenhofer, I'm a lesbian comedian. I know you're expecting someone who looked a little more like Leona Helmsley, but I'm the lesbian Barbie. I mean, they were just awful. Oh, and they laughed and laughed, you know, but it was 5 years ago.
Are you somebody else on stage?
No. I'm exactly who I am, but I'm my brain is just zooming, you know, and I don't walk off stage and remember what happened. My girlfriend will say to me, man, I can't believe how they responded to that, you know, that OJ joke or something, right? That was great. And I'll go, did they like that? Yeah, honey, they screamed for 5 minutes. Oh, good, good. I don't remember.
But you're somewhere else.
You're hyped up. Mm-hmm. You're very. It's like you're very, very focused, and you're not. Mm-hmm. I can't even explain it. It's the most bizarre feeling.
Did you ever have stage fright?
No. Oh my God, please. I was that kid in grade school who, when other kids were up there giving their book reports and couldn't wait until the class was over and were hoping that they wouldn't have to get up, I was going, sit down. You stink. I want to get up there. I'm going to be great. My book report is the best book report ever. You know, I went, please, can I have more attention? So that was not a problem.
Well, I found it funny in doing some research on you and talking about the kinds of stereotypes that even in
you researched me?
I did. Your dossier was sent to me. But
my FBI file.
Mostly it's what reviewers had to say about you. And it was that she's funny and she's pretty and all these very nice descriptions. And then this thing, and believe it or not, she's a lesbian. As if you couldn't be all these things at the same time. What is that?
Well, the stereotype, of course, is a lesbian is a woman who can't get a guy. I mean, that's always been, I think it even still holds true to a lot of people these days, you know. And so, first of all, you can't look like
right
someone's
kind of guy.
Right. Look like someone's high school prom date and be a lesbian. Unless, of course, you went to the prom with a lesbian. I don't know. I'm just saying in general. You can't look, you know, like Little Miss Girl Next Door and be a lesbian. That's unacceptable. And then I think during the 70s, when lesbians became at all visible, it was very much that they were humorless. You know?
And were they?
Maybe. Maybe the ones that were... you know, I was in the 70s. I was, you know, pretty much in high school. Sure, I remember. Junior high. But, but no, I do. I think that they were perceived as being humorless, and at some point they might have been because it was the first time they were getting any kind of attention at all, and they were being blamed for everything in the free world, you know what I mean, because feminists didn't want them and yada, yada, yada. And so, but those stereotypes have just really held true. And then all of a sudden the lesbian chic thing came down, and we had Katie and Martina and Melissa. But they still are women who look like what people can still put in a little tiny box and say, like lesbians. Okay.
And short hair. I mean, I'm just thinking of all the
right.
stereotypes.
Just sort of, I don't want to say masculine because I don't think that's true, although I think Martina might be perceived that way. Mm-hmm. I think that it's just a certain look that people think that's sort of jock, athletic kind of look, which I like totally don't look like I'm going to be playing any sports anytime real soon. But the reality is that lesbians look like everything. It's just that you don't know they're lesbians because they don't look like it, so you're not turning to look at them.
More from Suzanne Westenhofer after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to comic Suzanne Westenhofer. Well, let me go back then to junior high and high school. Now, I don't know when you got that first inkling that perhaps you were a lesbian.
I knew I was different when I was young. I mean, like 7, 8, 9, and 10. But I don't think I had any kind of word like lesbian or homosexual or anything like that.
What was different, though?
You know, that's the thing. The best way to explain, I don't know how if I could explain it, because I think a lot of kids have different thoughts about what they are like, that they don't fit in. But there's this knowledge that you have to keep a secret very early on. Something has given you that knowledge that you have to keep this secret.
Because it's dangerous.
Right.
There's something dangerous.
And you're not sure what the secret is. You see other girls, and they like Liz Taylor, and they like Susan Hayward, and they like Julie Andrews. Why is it a problem for you to like them? And yet you know, somehow instinctively, to not really focus on it, and to just be, you know, and to, I like Brad. He's so cute. You know what I mean? And you just go along with the flow. But I don't think, as far as understanding and accepting that I was a lesbian, I was 20. I had had some lesbian dabblings, if I may be so bold, prior to that. But, you know, that was like the late 70s. Remember that? It was like 79, 80. So it was like Cosmo would do stories about owning your own orgasm. And women were allowed to be and encouraged to be bisexual. So it was like trendy. It was like cool, you know. That was like for like a year, right? No, that was like a little while. You know what I mean? And so I didn't own that and see that as my being gay. Plus, guys were so cool. I mean, they would buy me things and pay for stuff and make a fuss. And I'm like, oh, well, this is fine.
Well, when you dated a guy, did it feel like play acting?
Yes, that's exactly right. It's like you're in a role when you're in a movie and you're just going off. And I wanted to be a movie star when I was a little kid, so I never even thought of it. It's just like I'm playing this part, and I'm being the best little straight girl ever. And I did. You know, I was a lead in all the plays, and I went to the prom, and he was the captain of the track team, and we did that whole shamil, you know what I mean? And then I promptly, like, went off to college, dated one or two last guys, last-ditch efforts, you know, because you don't want to go out until you're pretty sure. No, I'm teasing. And then I knew, and it was just ridiculous to hide anymore, and I came out.
Did you suffer?
No.
So coming out, telling your parents, telling your friends?
That all happened right away. I had one or two friends in college who were upset. And my best friend at the time felt very betrayed, you know, because we had gone out looking for boys and stuff, and we thought that was very funny. And we didn't speak until I was graduated college and she was graduated college, and it was a couple years later, and I was living outside New York City, and she called and said, oh, I've been a jerk. Mm. I was just a kid. I didn't know any better. And we're actually very good friends now. And I like her a lot, so.
So what does it mean to be out? Because we know that, I believe even...
I think there's all kinds of ways to be out. Mm-hmm. The first thing is you have to be out to yourself. There are a lot of people who don't acknowledge in their self their own homosexuality. I mean, they just go about, they get married and have kids, and they have these sexual dalliances on the side, and they just put it out of their mind. Those people, I think, that they're the saddest people. That's very sad to me. So you have to be out to yourself, and then you can come out, like you can be out in the gay community. Like you go to gay bars and gay bookstores and gay restaurants and gay areas like Provincetown or New Hope or Key West, right? Then there's out to your family and your friends. Then there's work. I mean, the levels just go on and on. And then there's like out, you're marching in the march, you're speaking at the Pride rally, you're giving money to this group and that group.
Well, I wonder how you are in public. My understanding is that your girlfriend isn't out.
Right.
I mean, you actually have she's part of your comedy routine.
Right.
She's nameless, but you certainly do talk about her.
Oh, I've named her even, too.
Oh, have you?
She's so happy.
Yeah. Well, are you trying to out her?
No. Oh, I'd never do that to her. She's not out because she teaches eighth grade. Forget about it.
Right.
Forget that. That's not happening. They fire her after 26 years of some of the best teaching she's ever. She's one of their best teachers. They love her. If they knew, she'd be gone. I mean, they wouldn't have to say they're firing her because she's gay. They'd find something else, and they'd hassle her until she had to go.
So when you're in public...
So she has 3 more years, then she can early retire, and then she's telling everybody. That's what she says. In the meanwhile, I'm about to spit needles on stage trying not to tell.
It's tempting?
No, I talk about my life. Here's my sister's gay. She just came out. She says to me when we're in Mexico, Suzanne, you know I'm dealing with this coming out gay thing. Don't go up on stage tonight when you're doing your show and talk about that. Don't do that. And I walk right up and I do it. I don't mean to. It's forefront in my head. So there it is.
How did she take it once you did it?
She loves me. So it was all right.
Even though it's challenged. Do you believe in outing in any way, shape, or form? Mm-hmm. Even under the circumstances of a public figure who has the ability to write legislation that would have a negative consequences on
I'm not sure that even in that way, because then what we're saying is, look, here's a really big jerk, and he's gay.
You'd rather not claim
somebody like
this. I
almost don't want
that.
Yeah, why claim them? You know what I mean? Although I understand what you're saying, say, oh, if we out them, then they won't do that. But that's not true. They don't suddenly become our friends because everybody knows they're gay. They're even more angry. So I don't know that that's of any value to us either. Why drag them out of the closet? We don't need that.
Let me talk about some of the work that you do with young people.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to schools, talk to high schoolers. I love this, using yourself, quote, as a human visual aid.
Yes.
I guess exhibit A.
Hi, I'm a lesbian. This is what we look like.
But what do you want young people to understand?
I go for 2 reasons, and I think you should know also that I will say this, that it's very difficult for me now to go because they're passing laws all over the place against that kind of thing. So it has really slowed down. It's a lot of trouble and controversy now, where in the beginning it was so nice.
Because you were seeing what as by as
promoting homosexuality.
As a recruiter?
Yeah, recruiter. Yeah, but that's us. We have time for that. Please. So I went, I go for 2 reasons. The first reason I go is because of the gay kids who are in that classroom, to give them a positive role model and a feeling that they don't, you know, that they're not alone out there. The second reason I go is for the kids who are going to grow up to be gay bashers. Meet me. Ask me the questions. We don't molest children. In fact, you know who molests children? I'll tell you what. Parents. Parents molest children. Parents beat their kids up. You know, like, what is that? Like 8 to 1. I mean, it's an unbelievable statistic. So don't tell me about that. We don't recruit you. We don't need you. We have a really nice looking team. You know what I mean? I don't want them to learn those things so that when they're running around, you know, let's go beat up some fags because they molest little boys. No, they don't.
Well, when you're in a classroom with a bunch of kids, and as you say, you're trying to head off some of this gay bashing, how direct are you? What do you say to like a 16, 17-year-old kid?
I'm pretty candid. I've had some kids stand up and say, you know, well, I'll tell you what, I beat up a gay guy. I beat up some fags. And I say, why? I said, you know, they think that most of those of you who do that are just really fighting your own homosexual feelings.
What do they say?
Oh, they hate that because they're 16. You know, they're gay, you know. And I'm like, well, then stop beating us up. If you didn't really have a problem with it inside your soul, what are you doing down there bugging them for? What's your problem?
What do they say back to that?
They get quite quiet and very pensive. You know, we talk pretty candid. I mean, I had a kid say that he couldn't, if his brother was gay, he'd kill him. You know what I mean? And people, even the other kids, I didn't have to say a word. They went nuts on him. I was just sitting there going, wow, he's like 15, you know? I said, who teaches him that? Mom and dad. Hello. You know who that is.
What do you want the gay kids to hear? The kids that may have some questions, they don't know. I mean, certainly we know that adolescence is a time of emerging all sorts of things.
I want the gay kids to not have to go through feeling alone and isolated and that there is no older gay people and that we don't have productive, normal lives. I want them to see that isn't true. Also, I just want them to like have a sort of a role model in that I know that if I had known one other lesbian existed, it would have changed my whole high school life. I'd have known immediately who I was. I would have never had to go through trying to be a heterosexual and being quite promiscuous because I'm thinking, oh, I'll find the right guy. You know, I never would have had to go through any of that.
Do you see yourself in some of those classrooms?
No, I haven't yet, but I've certainly seen the gay kids, even though they're not aware of it.
What do you see? How can you tell?
Gaydar is what we say. It's like a joke. But the best way is to just say, maybe it is that I'm seeing myself, but they don't maybe. But I'll look and I'll just see this young gal or this young guy, and I know it. And sometimes they won't look up at me because they're very much aware that maybe what they've been suspecting, you know, and then later they come up and talk to me for just like a real quick second. They go, oh, I think you're really cool. I thought you're really funny. And they run away because they see it too. It's a mirror. It's an amazing mirror to see it.
So which is a tougher audience, a club audience or a class of high school kids?
Class of high school kids. Because they see right through you.
Uh-huh.
They see right through you, so you can't just joke it away. You can try that, but they'll keep badgering you. Like if you say a joke to joke away something, they'll come around. Well, but what I asked was this. Well, but what I asked was this, because they're focused on that. They want that answer.
Right.
You know.
You enjoy it, though?
Oh, yeah. I wish I got to do it more. It's really sad how hard it is now.
Suzanne Westenhofer is performing next at the Berklee Performance Center in Boston on November 17th. Coming up, a music review from classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz. This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that two of the greatest 20th century exponents of the French repertoire were actually British. The British label Pearl has just released CDs by each of these singers, and they include two of Lloyd's favorite songs.
The British soprano Margaret Tate, T-A-T-E, was known to the world as Maggie Tate, T-E-Y-T-E. Debussy himself greatly admired her and coached her as Mélisande in his opera Pelléas et Mélisande. "She is Mélisande," Debussy said. She was the second soprano ever to sing this role. The first was another British singing actress, Mary Garden. Tate's recordings of Debussy's chansons, especially the one she made in 1936 with the great French pianist Alfred Cortot, are among the vocal treasures of the century. These have finally come out on CD. My favorite song is called Colloque Sentimental, Sentimental Dialogue. It's the last of Debussy's six settings of poems by Paul Verlaine, Fête Galante. "Do you remember our old ecstasy?" one of the haunted figures says. "Why do you want me to remember it?" the other ghost replies. "Does your heart beat at my very name? Do you still see my soul in your dreams?" "No." "Oh, the wonderful days of unspeakable happiness when our mouths were joined." "It's possible." "How blue the sky was, and how great our hope." "Hope has fled, defeated, into the black sky." Tate had one of the qualities I admire most in a singer, the ability when she's singing to sound as if she's talking.
Pourquoi voulez-vous donc qu'il m'en souvienne? Mon cœur bat-il toujours à mon sonneau? Toujours vois-tu mon âme en rêve? Non.
If anything, the British tenor Hedel Nash had an even more purely beautiful voice than Maggie Tate's, yet he too sings with the intimacy of speech, a sung whisper. He's probably most famous for his roles on the very first complete recordings of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro and Così fan tutte, but he was a beloved figure in a wide variety of operas, operettas, and oratorios. My nomination for one of the most gorgeous recordings ever made is Nash's rendition of the languorous tenor aria from Bizet's The Pearl Fishers, which in English becomes, "In memory I lie beneath the palms and dream of love." Nash makes even the Victorian diction sound intensely erotic.
Oh,
There are, of course, other marvelous performances on these discs. There's even another CD on which Tate and Nash appear together, a vocal summit meeting in a live 1938 radio broadcast of scenes from Massenet's Manon. But these two recordings define my own personal ideal, rare examples of those moments that I wish all singing aspired to.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed recordings by Maggie Tate and Hedel Nash on the British label Pearl. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller, technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Zipporah Lubar. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
I and you, for united in one,
I and you,
there shall none say a say, we will not hold the other way,
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting Blues Fest, modern blues of the 70s, 80s, and 90s, a collection of contemporary blues artists including B.B. King, Robert Cray, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.